The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing, state-of-the-art insights on what we can do to live a longer and healthier life. Then, I would like to offer up an analysis about Indian Point and why I believe it is one of the most important issues in America today. All the other issues have significance, of course. Global warming, that's a part of it. The acidification of the oceans, the lack of food for much of the world's population, the pollution within our own rivers and streams and lakes, and also loss of our topsoil. These are all important. The ghettoization of America, and of course, the enormous power that a small group of people hold over the rest of the world. But when you think about what the consequences would be if there is a complete meltdown, a Fukushima-style meltdown of Indian Point, you're looking at the potential to have the worst death rate in world history for a single event. So for those who believe that we cannot take down Indian Point because if we did, that we wouldn't have any other reliable source of energy, I'll address that. So this way we will show today that we can replace Indian Point's nuclear plants with cleaner and safer energy. And hopefully then we'll pass it on to the governor. Let's begin. I'm always asked, are there any types of natural sugars that could replace white sugar that would not raise my blood sugar? And the answer is yes, there's many. According to the British Journal of Nutrition, the latest one, the sugar was associated with a blunting of the blood sugar spike when ingested with sucrose or starch without stimulating secretion of insulin, and it is buckwheat sugar. Now, in addition, data from animal studies reveals a reduction in the levels of potentially pathogenic bacteria in the gut, as well as the promotion of potentially beneficial lactobacilli. Here's what it says, quote, based on all this evidence, defagamine, that's F-A-G-O-M-I-N-E, may be used as a dietary ingredient or functional food component to reduce the health risk associated with an excessive intake of fast digestible carbohydrates or an excess of potentially pathogenic bacteria, unquote. So this is good. So I'm not aware that this is on the market. I haven't seen it yet. But in the very near future, you'll be able to find buckwheat sugar. And that's because it has what is called defagamine, which is a naturally occurring sugar in buckwheat grain and buckwheat-based traditional foods. It's not brand new. It was first isolated in 1974, but they haven't done a whole lot with it since. Now they can because we've got an awful lot of diabetics who need it. I'm a proponent of green tea. I believe we should be consuming a minimum of 200 milligrams a day and upwards of 1,200 milligrams a day under normal circumstances. But if you have something like cancer, you could go much higher than that. Here's the latest study from Penn State University and published in the peer-reviewed journal Obesity. Green tea helps mice keep extra pounds off. I'll quote this. It says, green tea may slow down weight gain and serve as another tool in the fight against obesity. Obese mice that were fed a compound found in green tea along with a high-fat diet gained weight significantly more slowly than a control group of mice that did not receive the green tea supplement. That's according to the professor of food sciences who led this. We know that green tea is anti-carcinogenic. It can help prevent cancers from forming in the body. We also know that it stimulates the immune system in a positive way. So add weight loss onto that. Regular exercise is good for everything. Now we find out it's good for people with long-term kidney disease. This was done at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, and their report says the following. There are many reasons why people with chronic kidney disease often lose fitness and have increasing difficulty, performing normal daily tasks. I believe we should all be exercising 6 days a week aerobically, ideally either power walking very vigorously as fast as you can go without stopping, and or biking with high resistance, or if you're in a gym, then spinning at high resistance, and then doing resistance exercises for the rest of your muscles. A new study shows it's not just good for your heart and your legs, it's good for your kidneys, especially if you suffer from kidney disease. The Karolinska Institute in Sweden just published a study showing that those who engage in regular exercise have a substantial benefit if you suffer from chronic kidney disease. So, know anyone with kidney disease, let's get them exercising. And vitamin D could lower your risk of developing type 2 diabetes. This is from Science Daily, published in Diabetes Care. And they found that when the scientist did this research by giving people vitamin D, they found that fewer developed type 2 diabetes over a period of time. And this was very important because most Americans, especially this time of year, and until the spring, they're not going to get the amount and quality of sunlight that they should. In an ideal situation, you'd be getting about a half hour of sunlight over about one-third of your body. And that way, the sunlight will help the skin and chemicals in the skin convert that sunlight into vitamin D. That in turn helps turn off inflammation, prevents cancer, helps remineralize your bones. Just a whole lot of good things that vitamin D does, and also is terrific when you're going into what we call the flu season and or cold season, because it keeps your immune system stronger and there's natural antiviral protection there. Now we can add helping you prevent diabetes. But let's say you're pre-diabetic, which probably 50 million Americans are now pre-diabetic because they walk around chronically overweight. And then we have all the 25 to 28 million who are diabetic. And by the way, there's going to be a lot more. A lot of people just never get their blood, their fasting blood sugar tested. If they did, they'd start coming up with numbers like 150, 175, 200, when it should be about 75. And then they think, wow, I didn't know this. You didn't figure those night sweats, the constant urination, waking up many times a night, none of that. Getting up too quick and you're a little lightheaded, that could be blood pressure, but could also be blood sugar too. So now add vitamin D to helping a person who has diabetes or is pre-diabetic, and you should be taking that on a regular basis. The omega-3 fatty acids, they're good, especially for people who are over the age of 40, because they help turn off inflammation in the brain that can lead to neuron damage, and that in turn leads to memory loss, dementia, and Alzheimer's. Here is the latest reason to take your omega-3 fatty acids. This is from Science Daily, published in the peer-reviewed journal Osteoarthritis and Cartilage. Omega-3 fatty acids shown to prevent or slow the progression of osteoarthritis. This is done at the University of Bristol, and it wasn't a whole lot of the omega-3 fatty acids. I would suggest 2,000 milligrams, 1,000 in the morning and 1,000 in the afternoon. They're not even doing that much, and still they had these remarkable benefits for people who had arthritis. I remember once I was watching at the National Health Conference in New York City, all of the old-time nutritionists get up to lecture. And this was after my first really big crossover best-selling book, meaning it hit not only in the health community, which is a relatively small community. In fact, there was only one distributor of books to that community. It was called NutriBooks out in Arizona. And they would put books into the health food stores, and almost no one else carried health books except health food stores. You had Adele Davis, and she was the most popular nutritionist and author on nutrition at that time in the United States. Wonderfully pleasant personality. She was chronically overweight, But she reminded you of everyone's grandmother. And she really did well on television. Now, if you ever go back and read her old books, man, there's not a recipe in there that you would want, not by, today's standards. And but she believed that, once again, as everyone did at that time, high-protein diet, lots of meat, lots of fat, and not a lot of carbohydrates. In any case, I was invited by a man who I believe is still alive today, Clinton Miller, to come to the National Health Federation's national meeting, and it was being held at the Coliseum. And at that time, it was at 59th Street and Broadway. I went in the back where the speaker was supposed to go, and the first thing I noticed, the whole room was just filled with cigarette smoke. Now, I'm very young, and I was just very fortunate to have this big best-selling book. And the reason I think it was a big best-selling is because Mike Douglas, who had a television show out of Philadelphia, very nice guy, one of his producers heard me on, of all places, the Joe Franklin show in New York City. And Joe Franklin was the only guy I've ever been on radio with who didn't even have to look at you to interview you. He just had some pat questions he just asked everybody, none of them relevant to the issue. He was a hoot. But she was listening, and then she called me, and she said, you know, there's no one young in the field of health. I said, really? She said, no, the average age of the people in the health field are in their 60s. And here you're in your young 20s. She said, would you like to come do a Mike Douglas show? I said, sure. I didn't know who Mike Douglas was. So I, with my brother, Stephen, we took a train down to Philadelphia. And one of the Three Stooges was on that day. But I didn't know who he was because he didn't have his hair combed forward. He had his hair back. And then there was the guy, Dennis Weaver, who was in the movie Gunsmoke, or television series. And Bob Conrad, and he generally had 3 to 5 heavyweights. And then there was me. And because of everybody wanted to know something about that was wrong with him, and I was just sharing what I could, and Dennis Weaver said that he owned a health food store out in California. So we got along well, and then Mike Douglas had all these health questions, and I was answering them. And so it was so popular that I was invited back the next week. And then that just became a routine. I was on there all the time. And from there, Johnny Carson. And then it was just like almost, I was just thinking about this the other day, because I chose about 10 years ago just to stop the media. I just don't do interviews anymore, unless it's for something, a good cause, because I'd done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And then when you go out on tour, if you've never been on tour, you would find it more fun eating a bowl of broken glass than going on a book tour. You're picked up early in the morning, and you're driven to maybe anywhere. The most I've ever had is 22 interviews in one day, radio, television, print. You're rushing between these places. You're trying to stay fresh and make important points. By the end of the day, late at night, they get you out on a bus or plane to the next city, and you could do this, and I've done this as many as 40 days in a row. And but it sells the books, at least it did at that time. And in fact, in one of my very first book tours, I was in Pittsburgh, and I'm watching Irving Wallace, who wrote The Word. He sold a lot of books, very loved, very beloved author. And two people showed up, and I felt very bad for him. So just as I was supposed to start, and you sit at a table and you sign books, I said to him, I said, I'm really sorry that no more people came up. He said, oh, don't worry about that. He says, it's in my contract. I have to do these tours. He says, nobody comes to book. I said, why don't they come? He said, because today you can see anyone that you want to see, authors and celebrities, on television. He said, if I go on television and I talk about a book, I can sell 10,000 copies. On a whole tour like this, I won't sell 1,000 books. But it's that old way of doing stuff. And he said, this is going to be my last tour. I'm not doing this anymore. And I'm thinking, well, why? And I said, is it that people don't just want people's autographs? He says, "It's they don't care. We have become so intimate with, and I never will forget this, he says, we become so intimate with celebrities. we see them so often that we like them, but they're no longer exciting. That there's not that dynamic, and especially for authors. He said, yeah, movie stars, it's different. But he said, for us authors, we're considered intellects. It's a different appreciation. So I'm thinking, wow, that doesn't sound good. So what I did was, I couldn't do anything then. And sure enough, only a few people showed up. But probably about 20, but that's because they'd seen me on Mike Douglas. But then I decided to do something different. Right after that, I drove down to Philadelphia. And then when I was on the radio show, why did you write the book? I didn't say why I wrote the book. I just started talking about the diseases in the book. And I'm thinking, maybe people come out and appreciate the book. It was called The Complete Handbook of Nutrition. If there's illnesses they have, that will help them. No one's going to come and want my autograph. I'm a nobody. You know, I'm just a kid out here. And so that's what I did. And the place was mobbed. And the guy from the book department came over and said, we don't have enough books. Well, then that was the formula. So the rest of my tour just packed them in. And everybody came when they thought that there was something that could help them. And hence the idea, empower people. With everything you do, whether it's a lecture or a book or a film or counseling, make sure that when that person leaves your presence, they have something they can apply that can make their life better. Not just hope, but really practical information. And that's where I got into this habit of giving just great details in answers. And sometimes I'd do a lecture for 2 hours, but I'd spend 5 hours answering questions because I wanted everyone to go home with something they could use. But that became the beginning of what I was doing. But no one else was doing that. Anyhow, I jumped back up to New York, and here I've been on a whole year of national television and talking about health. And the book is just a monster hit. It dwarfed Adele Davis's books and all. So here I go to this. I'm invited to this conference. And two things I noticed when I walked in. First thing I noticed was everybody was smoking. And when I say everyone, I mean everyone was smoking. And then they had a refreshment table. They had a sign that says refreshments. And they're little pig sausages with toothpicks and all this really bad food and coffee, and then a whole bar. And I'm thinking, this doesn't look like it should be in a health conference, but I'm very naive, right? I don't know anything about the movement. I've never met any of these people. I had never had a chance to speak with any of these people. And so no one came over. I guess they didn't even know who I was. But they were all sitting and talking together. And I went backstage, and as each person came out, I just watched them and listened to their presentation, what they were talking about. And then I looked in the audience, and I didn't see a single non-gray haired person in the audience. They were all older people. And none of the spokespersons were healthy. They were all overweight. But one of the guys who was next to the last guy to go, I was the last person to go, his name was Dale Alexander. And he went up on stage, and he said, if you want to cure arthritis, you have to take 2 tablespoons of emulsified cauliflower oil on an empty stomach each morning. And if you do that, within about a month, you're not going to have any more pain. He said, it's the most important therapy you can use for this. And then he came off the stage. He weighed, I guess, about 400 pounds. He was mammoth. And he had arthritis in his knees. And he was bald-headed. And he had a book on how to grow hair, how to reverse arthritis, and how to stay trim. And I'm like, whoa, what part of this story isn't he actualizing? But the public loved him. Now, I'd later run into the same Dale Alexander, and it happened about 6 months later. Oh, and by the way, when I went out and I was introduced by Clinton Miller, now our last speaker, and he's got this best-selling book, and he's young, and the public just got up and walked out of the room. I didn't have anybody. And I'm looking around, and there's just no one sitting there. They all went out. They went to go see the other speakers. It was just like, well, who are you? You're too young to know anything. And And indeed, my talk would have been completely different. You know, I would have asked him about a detoxification and the dangers of meat and dairy and sugar. And outside, they had this whole table for the audience, all with bad food. So it was just a mismatch. And later, Clinton Miller came over to me. And he's a really nice guy. And he said to me, understand something, that you're probably disappointed. I said, I'm not disappointed, I'm confused. I didn't know why nobody wanted to stay in the room and listen to me. He said, because they're devout followers of the people who are here today. You know, Betty Lee Morales and Donsback and Carlton Fredericks and Adele Davis. These are the people that they've been with for 10, 20 years. And they make it easy for these people. Gary, your book is impossible. No one's going to follow it. You're wanting people to do all this kind of liver flushing and cleansing. No one's going to do that. Look at these people. Do they look like they are going to make any changes in their life? Look at the speakers. He says, look, I saw that you stood off in the corner. No one even came over and say hello to you. And when you tried to open up conversation, they just walked away from you because they resent you. Do you think they didn't know who you were? You're their replacement. They're at the end of their careers. You're at the beginning of yours, and there's no one in between. No one. He said, this is a phenomena. Why in the world they have not nurtured any younger people to take their place in sports? In any other field, you always have another group coming. Here you've had none. You're it. But understand something. Don't go after this crowd. Your messages won't work. You will turn these people off. They don't want to hear what you have to say. Well, I want to tell you, imagine how I felt walking home to my little apartment up on the Upper West Side. Nobody wanted to hear what I'd say, and nobody would say hello. And then I'm told that, well, forget that this, you got to start all over again. But I accepted it. I felt that I really appreciated his honesty. I don't mind bad news. At least it allows me to know the truth of what I'm dealing with. So that's when I just said, I will not again cater just to people who are not going to change. And that's why when I started on radio, I started and my audience initially was older because they thought, oh, it's going to be a health show, call in, ask about their hemorrhoids. No, it was talking about meditation and consumer activism and what they could do to clean up the water and get rid of pesticides like DDT. So it was very activist oriented, just like it is today. And I broke it into segments. Health and nutrition, part of it. Social activation of our energies towards important causes. Get rid of cyclamates, getting rid of saccharin. All these different, I must have 40 different issues I was encouraging people. And I remember when I did my first cooking class, 40 guys and one woman showed up. That's it. I mean, where I grew up, it would have been different. No guys would have taken a cooking class. But this is New York, far more cosmopolitan. People are more open to doing things like this. And so to this day, if you look around and you'll see that the people who were starting back then to make changes, they wanted whole changes. They didn't want to just change a little piece of their life. They want to change everything. And all those other people who were there, they all died in the next few years. Heart attacks, cancers, strokes. And it was unfortunate. I don't like to see anybody die young, but they did. And none of them made any changes. So we had a health movement without any healthy people. And that was a phenomenon. Come to the health movement, try to find someone who's healthy. You won't. It's like going in the 1980s. Go to the spiritual movement and find anyone who's spiritual. No. The leaders of it were spiritual materialistic. You know, as long as you paid them, they would give you a mantra to chant or tell you that you were, you know, sleeping beside a sacred bird. Whatever you wanted to hear, they'd tell you. Reality, a whole lot different. In some respects, not a whole lot's changed. Look at our politicians who tell us that what they're going to do for us, and then look at what they do. And like all those gray-haired people sitting in the audience just taking anything in that a person on the stage wanted to tell them, We have the Glenn Beck in their audience. We have all these people today who just, they cannot distinguish and differentiate their universal truth from that personal truth. Anyhow, that's just a little extended comment about cauliflower oil, because there's almost always a story behind everything. Now, protecting the brain when energy runs low. This is from Leeds University and Edinburgh and Dundee University. They have new insights into why the brain goes tired and why sometimes you're sitting there and you're starting to read and you just go to sleep, and why you can't remember a lot of things that happen. So they're saying that there's a way to protect your brain when it starts to, quote, run on empty. And that means there's some new treatments. Now, I looked at their treatments. I looked at what they're doing. And they're not doing any of this stuff that you're doing. Now, this is a part of it was published by the Proceedings National Academy of Science. And that is arguably the most respected scientific organization in America. Here's what they don't know. They don't know that NADH at 100 milligrams really power packs new energy into your brain. Coenzyme Q10, 300 to 1,000 milligrams, super energizes the mitochondria in your brain. L-carnitine, tocotrienols, and vitamin E from mixed tocopherols. Also, D-ribose all help energize the brain. So, gee whiz, I wonder how long it'll take them before they understand that we have the information that they need. But they're showing the phenomena. They're finally recognizing, yeah, brains run out of energy. Well, so do your leg muscles, and so does everything else. But if you know how to put the energy back in, good for you. Not with caffeine. This is from P.F. Lewis of Natural News, and it says, the CDC caught in blatant lies about pandemics and vaccines. And I was intrigued by this because it was last year that I published, along with Richard Gale, 12 articles challenging the CDC and the World Health Organization, and we claimed there was no pandemic, there was no epidemic, there wasn't even a large incidence of the H1N1, and therefore demanding flu shots or the H1N1 shots was wrong. And we showed the science behind that, and we were later shown to be correct. Now they're starting all over. Watch in the next month. They'll start saying 36,000 people die because of the flu each year. Not true. It's only about 1,200 people die of the flu. The others die from pneumonia. Completely different diseases. They lump the two together. It's on their own website, and we've pulled that down, so in case they ever decide to erase it. But that's the tell a lie enough, and then everybody believes it. So they keep saying, you got to get your flu shot. So next week, I'm going to be bringing out a definitive, original investigative reporting article, working on it now, on why the flu shot is a fraud. But then again, in 3 days from now, I'm going to be doing a one-hour special on why vaccines are not safe and what you should know. I'm only using their mainstream studies. So that's coming very shortly. Now, here's what they say. I'll quote this. The CDC relies on an authoritative presence to influence not just USA health policy, but world health policy. This prestigious presence also demands more federal funding, which is being questioned. It seems that the CDC's research and practices and expenditures have been under scrutiny lately. Although very few know of what has been hidden from public view regarding the CDC's investigations, there may soon be too much dirt for the White House to cover up completely. Remembering the 2008 swine flu hoax. Remember all those pandemic forecasts from the CDC when different high numbers of swine flu outbreaks were reported? A CBS News program called Washington Unplugged wanted to know more details on how those figures were derived, but the CDC stonewalled that reporter. To his credit, he went around the CDC by surveying each individual state's health agency, and he discovered that very few swine flu cases were reported by the CDC were confirmed as swine flu. Most were actually a normal seasonal flu, not the H1N1. The discrepancy between the CDC swine flu statistics and actual confirmed cases was too large to be considered sloppy record keeping. Upon further pressure from Washington Unplugged news producer, the CDC clamped down more and decided they couldn't track swine flu cases anymore because, quote, it was too difficult. The CDC quit doing what they're supposed to do because they got caught cooking the swine flu statistics. This was a rare case of kudos of the mainstream media. For those paying attention, it flagged the CDC's bogus promotion of swine flu shots for a flu that hardly existed and that many considered less dangerous than a normal seasonal flu. But then again, the CDC lies regularly about mercury in vaccines. From investigator journalist Tim Bolin of the Bolin Report, two-part article, the CDC has known all along how dangerous vaccines are and has covered it up. As early as 1998, the CDC knew that there were problems using thimerosal mercury in vaccines. This was especially true with the ever-increasing childhood vaccine schedule. Their own researchers turned in an internal draft stating the CDC decided to cover this up by hiring fake studies to explain away those mercury links to the autism rates. The earliest misleading study was the Daney study, a masterminded study by the CDC by Kristen Madsen, whose partner Paul Thorensen has recently been indicted for fraudulent funding activities. This epidemiological study became the cornerstone for the foundation of lies, supposedly proving thimerosal was not a factor for causing autism or other childhood developmental disorders. Boland states, quote, even the U.S. Congress began to smell the CDC stink and investigated. Now, a congressional committee released a 2003 report called Mercury in Medicine, Taking Unnecessary Risk. The report can be seen at vaccineprocon.org/source. Congressman Dan Burton headed the investigation. He had a grandchild who was vaccinated, then became autistic. And he was ruthless with vaccine industry and CDC representatives while he presided over hearings. The appropriate findings and excellent suggestions were ignored completely by the Bush administration and the CDC. Bolin wondered where anti-vaccine activist Bob Kennedy Jr. got 1 in 6 figures for developmental challenged children. Then he came across a bulletin from the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics issued in 2004 entitled Autism Alarm, which stated that 1 in 6 children had developmental behavioral issues. 1 in 166 was diagnosed with autism disorder. Bolin estimates that from 1998 to 2011, close to 12 million children worldwide have been afflicted with autism, making the worldwide autism ratio 1 out of 111 children. The CDC claims they don't understand how this all happened, they just know it is. The full title of the CDC is Center for Disease Control and Prevention. They're very heavily funded, but clueless about autism developmental disorders. So, just exposing the CDC for what it is. And finally, green tea shown to fight obesity. And this is a separate study. And this is the second study showing that if you're taking about 200 to 300 milligrams green tea, it helps prevent some of that fat from getting in your body. Oh, yeah. I had an email from a listener saying, is there any way that you can take things that could help block the excess estrogen that can contribute to breast cancer? Yes, resveratrol. Resveratrol has been proven by the Faculty of Pharmacy at the University of Calabria in Italy in a major study published in the FASEB journal, a major international scientific journal, that it blocks the effect of estrogen and can help to prevent the malignant growth of breast cancer in women. Now, this grape red wine derivative has been the subject of a whole lot of scientific studies in recent years, and it is enormously important because it lowers your risk of cardiovascular disease, cancer, and dementia. I believe that it is one of the single most protective nutrients you can take, and if you're taking different green and red powders, you're getting it. So be appreciative. You're way ahead of the curve. And all the women out there who are at risk because of their diet, stress, or being overweight, all of which create an estrogen dominance, this is one way to help your body because it can block that extra estrogen from making a difference and causing cancer cells. So that's it. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
You know I can't be found. Sit home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad, something I might have said. Please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Now, let's deal with some environmental issues. Also, forgiving student loans. I'm advocating that everywhere I go in America. Every time I go down to any of the students and young people on Wall Street, I'm giving out literature to them on how they can go about getting out of the student loans because it is a $1 trillion albatross around their neck, and no one should have to start their life with great unemployment numbers. I mean, they're just off the chart. If you're a young college student, you're about 38% unemployed right now. When I was graduating from college, many people in this audience, it was zero. If you had a good education, you got a job. Not today. And we didn't have debt. You have debt. So you don't have a job, and you have debt. You've got a law you cannot get out of because bankruptcy won't allow you to forgive the debt. And there's compounding interest on it. So you don't make a payment, the interest rate jumps. Then they attack your credit rating, and then they can arrest you if you don't make the payment. We shouldn't have this kind of really immoral and unethical law in our society. This is from Tomasa Nichols Bogaya from Common Dreams. And I'll quote this. How would your life change if all of a sudden you no longer had to repay your student loan debt? What would you do with that extra $1,000 of your paycheck every single month? If Congressman Hanson Clark, a Democrat of Missouri, has his way, this question might not be rhetorical anymore. Student loan debt forgiveness could be the stimulus measure that breaks us free of this long recession. What we're finding is that there has been a strangulation by record high student loan payments, more than any previous generation in American history, skyrocketing costs of higher education, high unemployment, and stagnant wages. A whole generation is seeing their plans and ambitions shackled by the extra weight of their student loan payments. These young people are unable to buy a home, start a family, or do the socially important but underpaid jobs in the social service sector where many recent grads cut their teeth. Congressman Clark's resolution, H.R. 365, aims to redirect the attention of government officials from reducing the federal deficit to addressing the real crisis facing millions of Americans and perpetrating this recession, the unrelenting financial drain on the economy caused by record levels of household debt. H.R. 365 also deals with home mortgage and personal debt, but as the millennial, the part one I'm most interested in his proposal is to forgive student loans. Acting on this resolution would provide a $1 trillion stimulus to the demographic most sought after by advertisers and by realtors, college-educated young people. These are the people that have the potential to revitalize the housing market and local economies. Best of all, this wouldn't just be a short-term money injection. This resolution would result in millions of people being able to keep more than 13% of their paycheck every month for 30-plus years, assuming standard loan interest rates and using average debt and wage statistics. Now, any measure that specifically targets students' loans and mortgage rates and other forms of personal debt carries some inherent social justice issues. This measure would do little to directly help the poor. On the other hand, eliminating student loan debt and helping those lower their home mortgages are investments that revitalize the middle class. This country used to take immense pride in its strong middle class, but it hasn't promoted its growth for the past 30 years. When the American dream was still achievable, a poor household could aim to achieve middle class status, but recent trends are showing just the opposite. Regardless of your work ethic, more and more middle class families are slipping into poverty, in part because of the heavy debt burden of household ownership and of pursuing a higher education degree. For the first time since the Great Depression, today's Americans are not likely to see a better standard of living than their parents. Another criticism rests on the assumption that if current debt is forgiven, it would discourage future borrowers from paying their debts back. This argument points to the real crisis in higher education. The problem isn't simply that people have too much debt, but that by choosing to enroll in an institution of higher learning to hone their skills and become a more productive member of society, they are essentially forced to. This is a financial burden that used to be largely taken on by the government, and still is in most other modern democracies, because it was recognized that the road to social and economic growth was rooted in an educated citizenry. Thus, while the criticism has some validity, it simply stands to underscore the need for reform of our systems of financing public higher education altogether, so people no longer have to take on such high debt. Now, I'll add my own two cents here to this. Here are some suggestions. These are just some thoughts. What if in the process of forgiving debt, we then made it mandatory that every single person that had their debt forgiven had to do community service work in the community where they're living or working for a period of years, let's say so many hours a week, something that wouldn't be overburdening, but also something that would be constructive for both the student and the society they live in. For example, how about going in and helping to establish counseling or some form of service for senior citizens, helping senior citizens, for example, to organize their life, to go shopping. How about helping with being a big brother and a big sister to orphan children? There's no shortage of things we can do to help make society better. And if that was part of the obligation, you would have a certain number of people that would not do it, but the vast majority of people, I believe, would do it. So that's a thought. Also, how did we get here? And no one's addressing this. We are not even questioning the validity of banks charging on a debit card that you haven't paid 1,000% interest. That brought the state of California and the banks $1 billion last year alone, just on the interest and late payments from debit cards alone. We're not even questioning the fact that you can pay an average interest rate, if you're the average American, of 29%. You miss a payment, it's 59%. At 59% on your debt, that's higher than a loan shark would charge you. Why don't we simply cap all interest rates at 2%? A 2% is a reasonable rate. People could pay that. And therefore, if you started off realizing that you're not going to be crippled by the interest you pay, and that you allow a person to be able to deal with bankruptcy based upon other conditions in their life, nobody actively seeks bankruptcy because it adversely affects you, your mindset, but it is a very important way in today's society to help people start over. And therefore, it's actually something that's very good. But the credit card companies work to kill that, so it's not in the laws. But what students, what student organizations, what parents had a chance to lobby to have the bankruptcy allowed for student loans? None. So on the one hand, we had ALEC meeting with state legislators and federal legislators dictating high interest rates, multiple fees, and no way to get out of the debt. On the other hand, we had nothing. We had a vulnerable public. So if we say there's no jobs unless you're educated, and then if you go to a school, even a public school, you're going to have to pay higher and higher fees, but no one stops and says, why are these fees? Why is it it's $27,000 a year to go to this public school? Why? And we're not asking, Where's the money going? Is it necessary? Look at the endowments for Harvard and Columbia and Duke, one of the largest endowments. We're talking about billions of dollars. Well, if you have billions and billions of dollars in your endowment fund, why not draw that down? Because universities are trying to compete. So one has to have a big Olympic swimming pool, then another pool, and then they keep adding on all these amenities as if the reason you want someone to go to that school is not because of the quality of the education and how it will prepare them to take on their position in society, but because you want them to have a great time and feel like they're in a Ritz-Carlton resort for the years that they're at that school. So the education becomes secondary to the amenities and then the growth. And we don't realize that if you just keep growing, nothing can grow indefinitely. And yet we do that. And then they have enormous overheads instead of shrinking themselves down and saying the purpose of coming to this school is quality education. Focus upon the education. Now, I remember when I bought my car, I got 42 miles to a gallon. And they say, but for another, you know, you can have cruise control. I don't need that. And I said, I don't want any of the extras. None of them. I saved $4,000. So I paid $13,000 for a car. All right, and gives me good mileage, lifetime guarantee on everything. And so if anything goes out, the tires, brakes, it's all covered. Well, that was a reasonable investment. Now, here's the issue. Imagine if I wanted all the extras. Do I really need them? So when we go to a campus, what do we really want? We want to know that there are quality teachers who are going to give us a good education, and the curriculum is one that we really will benefit from. Everything else is really secondary in importance. But not today. Today everything has to be pampered, everything has to be over the top, everybody has to outdo everyone else. It's a highly competitive system. But it doesn't mean you're getting better education, and now you got a lot of debt to go with it. So I just think we have to reassess this whole idea of capping. And I believe we should cap interest. After all, we reversed it. We took interest to zero for banks. And as we were giving banks zero interest so they could do anything they wanted with that money, no restrictions, we were increasing the mortgage rate, double-clicking it up off adjustables to a higher price for the homeowner. Now let me just put this in perspective. Let's just say that you're a person and you've worked and you work hard and you try to save what you can and you put your kid into a college. When I was going to college, you know, you either go on a scholarship or you find work, and because you didn't want to burden your parents in most cases. But not today. Parents feel absolute guilt if they're not responsible for every single thing that comes into their child's life more often than not, for a whole group of parents at least. And now you find out that your 3.8% initial interest is now 8%. The difference means that you don't have any disposable income. You can't go out to dinner, can't go to movies, can't do the things you once wouldn't have thought twice about doing, can't go on that vacation. You don't have it because it's going to the mortgage company. And then let's say you get really tied up, and then now you're looking and you start saying, okay, we have 9 credit cards. Let's pay these bills with this credit card. And then when that bill comes in, we'll pay that with another credit card. And when that bill comes in, we'll pay that and another. And we can get ourselves about 60 days. So you're living in this chronic debt peonage cycle. You can't get out. So then one day you're told that you're going to have to be cut back or let go. So you cut back, but immediately you don't change your lifestyle. And by the time you're forced to, you find that all those things that you paid retail for, nobody wants. Oh yeah, they'll buy them, but at 15 cents on the dollar. And you argue, but I paid $3,000 for that. I paid $1,800 for this. And someone says, okay, but I can't reimburse you for your bad choice and what you paid. And then you think, okay, let's go to the mortgage broker. So you go back to the mortgage broker. You even find the one at the bank that you originally bought your house from. And you say, we're having a little rough time right now, and we figured we'd take a little bit of the equity out of our house, and because I got this, you know, student loans for my kid, and we're having all of our payments, and the mortgage broker says, well, I can't do that. Why not? Because when you bought your house, it was worth $400,000, but now it's worth $300,000. So you have no equity in your house. In fact, the bank is going to actually ask you to come up with some more collateral. So now you're living in a house that will never get its value back, ever. The assets you bought are grossly devalued. The things you thought you couldn't live without are now junk. And on top of that, you have to sit with your kid and you have to say, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to go to a state school. I can't afford this private school. Which causes its own whole dynamic, inter-family dynamic. And you become the bad father more often than not. Because nobody feels good with that kind of change, though it may be necessary. And then you start adding up all your debt, and you look at your future, and you are nothing but a debt slave. Your house, your car payments, and everything else that everybody told you was just be fine are not. And yet you don't want to really unload everything. At that moment, you should just sell everything and rent and start from scratch. But part of our ego just doesn't allow us to do that. We don't want to admit to our family and friends that we got caught up in circumstances beyond our control, or we didn't get ahead of this when we had a chance. And so we stay too long in uncertainty. And then it's just a whole series of arguments. How many people are faced with the scenario I just stated? 250 million Americans. We almost never talk about them. We talk about debt, but we don't personalize it. Rarely. And these people are frustrated, but they don't demonstrate. Their kids might, but they don't. And they tend to be very focused upon someone's going to solve the problems, but there's not going to be a solving of these problems. They want to get an idea what's ahead of them. Have them watch what's going on in Greece, if they can handle that. Because that is going to come here in 2 years. So now at some point, there should be an idea that someone says, hold on a second. The person that we were just speaking to at Bank America, they just got $1.2 trillion from the Federal Reserve at zero interest. Why can't the government give us some interest and at least wipe out the late fees and penalties and give us a flat interest? Why didn't the bank bring down our interest payments to 4%? We can handle 4%, but we can't handle 8%. The banks won't do it. Unmitigated greed. So the real nature of the entire banking system is greed. But the difference is they have a rich uncle, Uncle Sam. The Federal Reserve, the most corrupt, vile, inhumane, fraudulent organization in American history, controls everything. They control liquidity. They control the fluid flow of money out into the world. They don't have to give actual cash, not needed. They do it all on a computer. And they have nothing to back it up. They have no collateral at all. It's all an illusion. So when Bank America needs $1 trillion or Citigroup needs $2 trillion, they get it. Zero interest. When you need to stay in your home, you don't get that break. When you need a lower interest rate, you don't get it. You get more. So on the one hand, you're penalized and you're charged more interest for being poor, and those who are rich who've mismanaged the money get more for less. That is the problem. We could do an enormous amount if we just got rid of all late fees, penalties, and brought everyone's interest rates down to 2-4%. Suddenly you'd revive this economy completely. So that's one of the reasons I'd like to see the student loans establish new standards. and part of the standard would be community service, where you would get, and also I would suggest that we do far more on public education than private education, so that there's more public education that a person could actually work within your community, and that would be applied as a percentage of your tuition. So there's a community-based student loan input. I've been thinking about that for a long time. We need a whole lot of help with our society, and we're not getting it. That'd be one way to help. Next up, this is about nuclear power. And this is an argument to challenge Mayor Bloomberg and others who say we cannot close Indian Point. We have nothing to replace it with. In point of fact, we can. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, a wide range of safer, cleaner energy options is available to replace Indian Point Energy Center if the nuclear plant is not relicensed in 2015. That's according to an independent analysis commissioned by the Natural Resource Defense Council and Riverkeeper. And thanks to an energy generation surplus, it can be done at no impact to the reliability of the region's electricity supply and at modest cost. A related new analysis of the costs and consequences of an accident at Indian Point also revealed it could cause a catastrophic event, worse than that of Fukushima in Japan. Quote, "The world watched the nuclear crisis in Japan with fear and heavy hearts. No one wants to see a repeat here, in one of the most densely populated regions of the country." That's according to Francis of the group. Quote, "Fortunately, we have a wealth of safer energy sources ready to go immediately that can fully replace the power from Indian Point. When we consider the human and economic costs of a nuclear crisis in New York and the host of benefits from investing in clean energy, the solution is common sense." There's this new risk analysis that compares the human and financial cost of the Fukushima disaster to the potential risk of a nuclear crisis at Indian Point and reveals that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission still underestimates the danger posed to Indian Point from seismic activity. An accident at one of Indian Point's two reactors on the scale of the recent catastrophe in Japan could send a fallout plume south to New York City and the whole area, including New Jersey, that would require the sheltering or evacuation of about 20 million people. Fortunately, a wide range of alternative energy options are available today that can replace the full electricity capacity provided by Indian Point Energy. Findings show that energy efficiency and renewable energy sources such as wind and solar alone could meet energy demand in the region. And there's additional capacity available through new transmission projects and for making existing natural gas power plants much more efficient. A new report prepared for the Riverkeeper by economics consulting firm Synops Energy examines energy alternatives to Indian Point. The report finds that there is currently a surplus of electricity capacity in the regions near Indian Point, including New York City, and that even if the Indian Point units were to close when their current operating licenses expire in 2015, there will be no need for new electric capacity to meet reliability requirements until 2020. The replacement options identified in the report are either already underway or can be implemented well before then. The report's entitled Indian Point Energy Center Nuclear Power Plant Retirement Analysis. So we have a lot of energy we're saving, so we could close down Indian Point tomorrow and would not have a problem with it. So for those who believe, well, what are we going to do? You don't have to worry. It's already there. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Hey, donny, ding, dong, a lang, a lang, a lang. Boom, ba-do, 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 ba-do.
Oh, life could be a dream.
If I could take you up in paradise up above, if you would tell me I'm the only one that you love, life could be a dream, sweetheart. Hello, hello again, shaboom, and hoping we'll meet again. Oh, life could be a dream, if only all my precious plans would come true. If you would let me spend my whole life loving you, life could be a dream, sweetheart. Now every time I look at you, something is on my mind. If you do what I want you to, baby, we'd be so fine. Oh, life could be a dream if I could take you up in paradise up above. If you would tell me I'm